I just learned that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age, meaning, depending on lifestyle habits, someone can either accelerate or decelerate the aging process. But just where do you stack up? That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. I just completed my True Age test, and I'm super excited to see what it reveals about my health. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at TrueDiagnostic.com by using the code Harris at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TrueDiagnostic.com. Just use the code HARRIS to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. Lot to get to, short time to get there, so we're just gonna jump right in after a few announcements. I'm actually gonna be leaving for a trip in about an hour, so I got this deadline that I'm trying to squeeze out a podcast this week, though, because I've done a few short clips on YouTube. Some of you have seen those, but I have been busy this week recording an audiobook that in total is over 8 hours long, and formatting that and getting it ready for Audible. It's not on Audible yet. It's not on Amazon yet. It is not published yet. It's called Against the Waves, Christian Order in a Liberal Age. And it's everything's waiting. I got the final draft and everything, but it's not up yet. And if you are a patron, if you are a member of Patreon.com, here's what it looks like. Patreon.com/John Harris Podcast. You have access, early access to that complete audiobook. You can listen to the whole thing ad-free. And this is probably going to be a limited time thing because I think I have to sign an agreement with Audible once I put it up there for them to have exclusive rights. But if you go to John Harris podcast on Patreon, you can sign up. You can listen to the whole thing. You can give me feedback. I've never done this before, but it's really a thank you to my patrons for their support. And hopefully, if you like it, you can say something nice about it, maybe when it comes out, and that will be worth it to me as well. So I want to let you know what I was doing this week and why I haven't been podcasting as much. That's a big part of it. I'm also going to be speaking in a number of places. So you can go to johnharrispodcast.com and go to speaking engagements, and you can see where I'm going to be. But there's the Political Christianity Conference next weekend, and that's in Vancouver, Washington. And then the weekend following that, Reformation War Room in Shelbyville, Kentucky. So I hope you can make one or both of those, depending on where you live. I'd love to see you at those events. Okay, so the big news this morning is a big news. I mean, it's trending on social media. I guess you could say it's big. Big news is Ashley St. Clair. Ashley St. Clair, who, well, according to her, and I don't think this has changed, at least now. I'm kind of hoping it does, but she is. She works for the Babylon Bee. She handles operations, according to a post she made in 2023, and I'm not sure if that is has changed or not, but you can see the circles she runs in. There's Joel Berry, there's Jenna Ellis, there's Kyle Mann, there's Seth Dillon, and she's worked for Turning Point USA. Anyway, the news is that she has had a relationship of some kind, of some nature, I don't know to what extent, with Elon Musk. They're not married, but she is having his child, what is it, like 12th or 13th child, and there's an interesting dynamic going on right now on social media where you have people, even professing Christians, that are taking her side. And what's her side, you might ask? Well, she's worried that the media is going to uncover that Elon Musk is having this child with her, so she's beating them to the punch. She's coming out first and saying, yes, we are, and kids are off limits. And so she's taking the moral high ground to tell them, you know, they're trying to use kids as political pawns. We're not going to let that happen. And I see people carrying her water on that. And there's only one simple point that I wanted to make on this, and that's this. I think that we have there's a good tradition out there of making sure that children, meaning young people who are not adults, are off limits as far as you can't use them as in political attacks. Now, some might disagree with that, because even in the requirements for being an elder, your kids need to be behaved. I'm obviously summarizing. Some people think that means your kids needs to be saved and that kind of thing, but they need to at least be in good order. They need to, whether you think that means they're believing or they're behaved, there's an evaluation that happens with someone's children, which I'm not getting into for the purposes of this podcast. The only reason I bring it up is to say that there is a requirement there, right? And it doesn't require evaluating children. So I'm okay with people disagreeing, but I personally think that in our media environment where we're at right now, it's probably a good thing that in general, kids are off limits. You can't just use them. And I'm talking about young people who are not adults. You can't use them to attack someone because you disagree with their policies. That's generally how it's framed. I think the same goes honestly for a wife. You shouldn't, just because you disagree with someone's policies, you shouldn't use them in ad hominem attacks and that kind of thing. Now, I think there are exceptions to this. I think, you know, if you have, you know, a 17-year-old, let's say, who's out there dealing drugs or whatever, like this should probably be taken into account. Why is that happening? What dynamics led to this? If you can't manage your household, are you going to be able to manage the country or your state or your region, whatever? But we're not even talking about that. Let's say you agree with all of that. This is the point I want to make. How the kids got here is a different question than the existence of these kids. So, you know, don't use children as part of your political attack. Got it. But we're not talking about the children and we're not using them. It's your actions. It's how the kids got here. And, you know, is Elon Musk the kind of person who has a fling with someone and there's really no commitment beyond that? And maybe because he's rich, he's able to, I don't know, do that kind of thing. And it doesn't suffer as many consequences. I think that is something to take into account. Now, that said, the Democrats obviously have absolutely no moral standard. And that's a bigger, I think, issue here. They have no way to point at that and say it's bad, to condemn it. They have no moral standard for themselves. And so if they want to apply your moral standard or your side's moral standard to you, they're the epitome of hypocrites. And I agree with all of that. And Elon Musk is hopefully, and I think this is probably true, doing a good job with rooting out some of the corruption in the government. So that doesn't take away from that necessarily. But we really can't fall for this whole line of the kids are off limits. Therefore, you can't talk about how the kids got here and the nature of someone's fidelity and commitment and all the rest. I mean, these things are important. These things should be used to evaluate political leaders, at least on a certain level. So that's the only point I wanted to make. And the fact that she works for the Babylon Bee to me is just a little bonkers. But let's get into some of the evangelical news stuff that I've been putting off because of the book. So Wheaton College, they put out a statement. So Russ Vought, who is working in the administration, was confirmed, and they at first congratulated him, which is normal for colleges to do, and then they decided to renege on that, and they retracted it, basically. So they say it's something they stand. Yeah, it is something they typically do. The political situation surrounding the appointment led to a significant concern expressed online. It was not our intention to embroil the college in a political discussion or dispute. Our institutional and theological commitments are clear that the college, as a nonprofit institution, does not make political endorsements. So they're saying we don't endorse Russ Vought, who is the leader of the Office of Management and Budget in the White House. And, you know, this is interesting. This is rich to me. You know, this is just, yeah, I don't know. No, it's just... I look at this and I just think not even a secular college does this kind of thing generally. And actually Chase Davids points this out. He says, look, Ohio State University congratulated Vice President-elect J.D. Vance because he went to Ohio State, and they're a secular university and they never did this. They never apologized because of, you know, or I should say they never had to clarify because of blowback they received. This is just a standard thing. And it just shows you kind of how woke, how compromised some of our institutions are. And I say woke on purpose for Wheaton because they definitely are on a certain level. I have insider stuff I know about them, but just look at the videos I did about a month or two ago, where we looked at some of the reaction to an event they hosted where you saw reaction to the election, and it was completely anti-Trump. And then, you know, Samuel James, who writes for the magazine or the outlet World Magazine, Samuel James, he said, "Institutional cowardice is a real plague. That being said, I do wish some of my fellow evangelicals would show one third the amount of public angst over racism within Christian nationalism as they do the social media embarrassment of Wheaton." So this is, I think, a tactic to defend Wheaton. He says, "Emotional blackmail is real. It's real when alumni performatively weep over a generic Facebook post, and it's real when those who mock this admit in text messages and DMs things they won't post because they couldn't handle their mentions if they did." And so I retweeted Josh Abbotoy. "Which major evangelical institution do these ostensibly racist Christian nationalists control?" This is a really good point, because, you know, none of these supposed race. I don't know who you cast a wide net when you use that term racist. What are you talking about? But presumably these people aren't in charge of an office to the extent that Russ Vought is. They're not where J.D. Vance is. They're not where any of these people in the administration are. So they have actual authority. They have institutional credibility. None of the people that Samuel James is talking about presumably have any of that. And this is one of the dynamics. I just wanted to say this, that I think it frustrates me, is I will get people sometimes tell me, "John, you need to go after Anons on Twitter or X. You need to..." And the thing is, like, I've been attacked by some people on X for not being, I guess, I don't know, white nationalist. I'm not sure. I'm not exactly even sure where what the attacks are, but I'm not down for their cause. And some of them seem like biological determinists to me of some variety, but it's hard to tell. You don't always know where someone's coming from. And these are things that I think require oftentimes longer conversations to figure out because of all the static that's been introduced through politics, and because some of these are complex topics. One of the things I go through in my book, so I talk about all this stuff. And I mean, I told Joel Berry that not long ago, because he was kind of coming after me, and I was like, "Joel, I talk about this in my book, and I do it carefully, and that's how I want to do it. I don't want to have an expat where we're not understanding each other. We're talking past each other. My side is rah rah, your side is rah rah." Generally, I think for these discussions, if we want to have an informed discussion, it's better to have a longer conversation and really define terms and that kind of thing. Anyway, all that to say, regardless of all that, the people that generally are the concern, or the, you know, these Anons or whatever, these racist people on X, they don't control anything. They have no institutional credibility. They have no, and you might say, "Well, some of them might be powerful leaders. We don't know. They could be used..." Okay, if that's true, the fact that they have to be secret about it proves my point about their unsavory views or whatever that society would, you know, kick them out for. They wouldn't have their spot anymore. That's proof that they wouldn't have their influential position if they have one, because they have to remain anonymous. And the ones that don't have institutional credibility. They're not in the Department of Defense. They're not in the vice president's spot. They're not working for the Office of Management and Budget. So this is a very important distinction. And I think it's lost on people like Samuel James. It's not, frankly, it's lost on a lot of people. It's lost on people like, even, I think Neil Shenvey's made this mistake before. And I think some of you might not even know who I'm talking about with Samuel James or Neil Shenvey if you're not on X, but there's guys out there who try to make this point quite often. And the thing I've said is, like, look, if there's an ideology destroying your life, that's a threat to your life, and you know, there's sin issues, whatever, that's something to address. But it's not as big of a problem if you're not influencing other people's lives, right? This is a very easy concept, I think, to understand. If you are making a bad decision for your family, that's a bad decision for your family. And, you know, it may affect other people in your circle, but if you have a small circle, it affects less. And it's not going to be, frankly, worth my time on a podcast. But if you have institutional authority, and it, you know, a lot of people work for it, a lot of people are influenced by it, and you make bad decisions, like we saw in the woke stuff in 2020, I'm going to talk about it, because your impact, your effect, your beliefs are having a bigger impact. And this should not be a hard concept to grasp. But I think people like Samuel James have a hard time with this. They're just looking out there and they're seeing views that they find objectionable, when you got to take into account, okay, who are these views affecting? What is the social mores of society? What do they... what direction do they cut in? Against it, for it? And very clearly, if you are called a racist, you are not, you have to defend yourself, you're run out of town on a rail, you lose your job. I mean, all this stuff is still in place, guys. This didn't go away just because some people who, some of them tend to be anonymous on X, are able to say things that are edgy that they wouldn't have said maybe a few years ago because there were controls on X or something. Like this is, this shouldn't be hard to comprehend. But anyway, I figured I'd point that out. Samuel James works for World Magazine. So we're going to talk about other evangelical institutions here, but I want to talk about the Pope first. The Pope sends a letter to U.S. bishops slamming mass deportations, says illegal immigrants are not criminals. And of course, there were some good responses to this by members of the administration who are Catholic. Now I'm blanking on the name of the guy who's deporting. I'm going to have to Google it here. The border czar. What's his name? Why am I? It's early in the morning. And sometimes I have these, you know, it's like on the tip of my tongue. Border czar Tom Homan. Tom Homan. Thank you. Thank you, Internet, for helping me remember that. Tom Homan had a great response to this. So did J.D. Vance. Basically, you know, stick to your lane and you're woke to the Pope. And this is, I think, this illustrates something that I think Catholics are going to have to navigate. If you're a conservative Catholic, even if you're a trad Cath, you're going to have to navigate this. Your Pope is against your civilization, against your way of life. And you say, well, you know, look at Protestant pastors who are like that. Okay, we can look at Rick Warren, who posted something that was silly the other day. We can look at J.D. Greer. We can look, whoever you want to pick. You can look at David Platt. They're not the Pope. Their office is very different. Kind of like what I was talking before about people who don't have influence online versus people who have institutional influence. The Pope has the epitome of institutional influence in the Catholic Church. These other pastors you're talking about have limited influence in their sphere, and they can't speak ex cathedra. They can't contribute to the doctrine of the church other than to evaluate it. They can't create it. And they're not the particular head of the organization. They're not the vicar of Christ. This is a problem for Catholics. This is part of your church's hierarchy at a very deep level and a very fundamental level. So just something to consider if you're a Catholic who's watching this. How do you justify your membership in the Catholic Church when literally your Pope is lined up against your very civilization, your very way of life? And I think previous popes probably would have had a big problem with him, but they're not the Pope anymore. He is. And it seems like every denomination, just about, okay, maybe not every, but a lot of denominations weighing in on the immigration thing. This is becoming a very big deal. This is from the Wesleyan Church headquarters. Wesleyan Church, or wesleyan.org, is the website. The nations are our neighbors. This is a newsletter from February 2025, hot off the press. Immigration is an issue. Immigrants are people. There are certainly issues to be resolved, but most important in our words and actions, incarnating the greatest commandment. So to love your neighbor, it's always this vague notion of loving your neighbor that becomes the pathway for citizenship or amnesty or whatever. And let's see, they talk about, here's, I think, the important part here. Immigration is once again being, as it has continually been discussed, debated, and in some ways becoming divisive as the North American Wesleyans. We need to remember and demonstrate the commitment we made to our immigrant brothers and sisters 17 years ago. So for some of you, this is new. You haven't heard this before. You didn't know your denomination had these stances. A lot of them have had these positions for a long time. So 17 years ago, we must treat all persons with dignity, including those who have entered the country illegally or who entered legally but are now out of status with immigration authorities. What does that mean, by the way, dignity? You see, these are vague notions. We don't know. So dignity, like treating them like they should go back to their country, is that treating them with dignity? Does that violate dignity, right? So this is part of the problem, is that they weaponize these terms, and then you can't really shoot back because, you know, you're against treating people with dignity, but they're using it to push an agenda. They're trying to imply that there's a problem with people not treating them with dignity, right? Tom Homan's treating them with dignity. Donald Trump's treating them with dignity. Why not? Right. But they're implying that that's not the case. We will give ourselves and wholehearted love to others without intolerance, judgment, favoritism, or disrespect, in spite of who they are or what they have done to live amongst us. Well, this is right against the order of Maris. Do you do this for your neighbor's kids? You treat them just like you'd treat your kids? Of course not. But this sentence would imply that, I suppose, right? We will exercise awareness of the laws as they pertain to immigration. We'll endeavor to obey them and encourage all immigrants to do the same. Well, that sounds like, you know, that's true, right? You should be happy with what's going on. The laws are finally being applied. But I don't think so, because it says, unless these laws are contrary to God's word as interpreted by the collective wisdom and authority of the body of Christ, which is an interesting way to put it, the collective wisdom and authority of the body of Christ. With what? What are we even? What is it? I don't even know what to make of that. That's not a Protestant, typically a Protestant framing of the authority of God's word. We will encourage one another to engage in acts of kindness and compassion, providing things towards immigrants who are in need, regardless of their status. Okay, I mean, would you do that with any other criminal group, right? Would you say, people, we're going to treat people with dignity, even if they've stolen something. We're going to provide shelter, food. I mean, this is not the kind of thing you see with any other issue, but this one, you see it. We oppose and condemn all unjust and harsh laws. Harsh law. You know, law is force. Law is compelling people to do things they don't want to do. Oftentimes, it's means coercion. That's the nature of law. Policies and measures directed against immigrants among us, whether documented or undocumented, we will act as advocate for just and humane policies for all peoples by all levels of the government. This is just a bunch of propaganda. And I mean by that, it's a left-wing slanted statement. And there's no doubt about that. But this is the Wesleyan Church and the Church of the Nazarene. I wanted to show you, let's see, I think this is the one I wanted to show you first. The Board of General Superintendents has called the Church of the Nazarene to show compassion for the immigrant and refugees. Oh, at its February 2025 meeting, they're all doing this, February 2025. And the significant global immigration and divisive political debate in many nations compelled the Board of General Superintendents to speak clearly and biblically to this challenging topic, inviting all Nazarenes to express Christian love to immigrants who live among us. The Hebrew word ger and the Greek word xenos can be defined as immigrant. If an immigrant dwells with you in the land, you shall not mistreat them. The immigrant who dwells among you shall be to you as one born to you and shall be loved as yourself. You know, I pointed out before, you use these Old Testament rules and try to take a general principle from them with ignoring the context. You make a big mistake, because in the Old Testament, you had a situation where, first of all, it's the ancient world. They don't have the mass transit and the overwhelming amount of people coming. If you had the amount of people coming in the Old Testament, it would be called an invasion. They're not talking about that. And they are making a distinction. The immigrants are different than the citizens or the natives. So the immigrants come and they can't hold land in perpetuity like Israelites are supposed to. And it goes back to them in Jubilee. I mean, there's a number of things that they can't do. They can't be a leader in the community. They can't become a king. They can't become a priest. They can be perpetual slaves. Hebrews can't. I mean, there's all these things in place to prevent them from essentially benefiting from the unique privileges that Israeli or Israelite people were supposed to have. That's an important point to make. And I showed you the other day the billboard I saw in LA last year, where they're in Spanish in an area where there's a sanctuary city. It advertises, you can go get your social security card here. This is the kind of thing that's happening in our country. This is very different. The conditions are very different. If you want to, you know, restore conditions to the Old Testament time, and you want to say, yeah, you can come here, but if you're foreign, you can't buy land. You can't. You have to convert. Also, you have to abide by our laws. You really want to become an Israelite, conversion is the first step. But guess what? We have a court of the Gentiles. You don't go past that. I mean, like, you want to bring in all this kind of stuff and make you the United States a more theocratic kind of, like, if they're for this, they should also be for the civil penalties for sins in the Old Testament, like adultery. They should also be for creating a theocratic kind of society, right? They should also be for some of the laws I just described that create or demonstrate a difference between the citizen and the native. But they're not for any of that, right? Because they're hypocrites. And the only thing that they care about, I think, is supporting the left-wing agenda. And why would they support the left-wing agenda, you may ask? Well, I think there's one reason. that could be potential here. Here's the grants received from the Nazarene Compassionate Ministries Incorporated. You go through this. I'm not going to read through all of this, but I will show you on the screen. And if you want to look through it, if you're a Church of the Nazarene person, go to ncmi.org. You can find all the grants received here. And there's definitely U.S. aid here. There you go, right there. $800,000 from United States Aid for International Development. There's all kinds of things in here that have government connections. There's tons of U.S. aid. I've told you for a while that there is a component to this whole debate. There's an ideological component, but there's also an incentive coming from just money. People love money. And when you are on the dole, when you're on the payroll, then you don't want that to stop. And a lot of these denominations, this is a smaller one, the Nazarenes. I mean, this is a smaller denomination compared to like the Southern Baptists, but they're on the dole. They're getting this kind of these grants and so forth. And you don't think that affects their political stance? You bet it does. And if you want to know, I think, who the hub of a lot of this, it's Matthew Sorens. Matthew Sorens with World Relief. Now, Matthew's kind of like the Ed Stetzer, where, you know, you see Ed Stetzer get, you know, become part of a denomination, have an office in an organization, go to a college. I mean, he gets around. It's like they're going to become woke. They're going to all of a sudden adopt these policies. I mean, that's the pattern, at least I've kind of noticed with him. Like where he is, it seems like that they're working on becoming more woke or something. Matthew Sorens is kind of like the hub of the immigration issue. And let me just give you some posts. This is from really all relating. This is just to the Church of the Nazarene. And Matthew Sorens, I don't even know if he's a Nazarene. He gets around, though, in evangelicalism. This is all the way back from 2016. Our mission at World Relief is to connect theology and praxis, empowering local churches to serve the vulnerable. And he commends Joel Tooley, the Nazarene pastor, who's very left-wing. This is from 2022. President Dan Boone, the Nazarenes, you know, writes about the mother and her dreamer son who shaped his convictions on immigration policy and inspired him to find a way to admit hundreds of DACA recipients to study at his Christian college. So that, you know, they're involved in public policy. He wanted the Dream Act, but he's enmeshed in these organizations, these denominations. I could just show you this stuff, honestly, all day. In the U.S., he says, I often hear, I've never thought about it that way before. I've never realized the Bible mentioned immigrants so often, which I think is part of a vicious cycle. Churches don't preach on what the Bible says about immigrants. Well, they don't preach on what I just said. And it becomes even more risky for pastors to preach because they're upsetting their congregations because the folks have been discipled by Fox News. Thanks, Matthew. Thank you. A bunch of Nazarene pastors from all over the U.S. are signing this letter. And it's a letter to essentially, this was in 2018. To President Trump. I'm trying to remember because there's been a few letters. This is one of the immigrate. Oh, this is on the family, supposed family separations or alleged family separations. I could say just family separations because there have been separations. But as I've said before, I mean, a lot of this has to do with trying to figure out whether the kids coming here are actually the children of these parents or they're being smuggled in. There's tons of child trafficking, sex slavery, all of that happening at the border. And we have to have policies to be able to approach that. And I mean, and this is a scale issue too. When you have so many people coming in, sometimes they have to be separated for, if you don't want to do that, you don't come here. I mean, it's a simple thing, but you know, it's so inhumane. We need to sign a letter. Okay, man, I don't know how much more we can take, but here's Matthew Sorens again, commending Joel Tooley, Nazarenes. It's all about the immigration policy. And he just does this over and over. Nazarene Seminary. Joel Tooley says, check out the Preachers Conference, pre-conference focused on immigrants. This is, for those who don't know, this is how the evangelical gravy train works. Yes, you know, World Relief is getting a lot of money from USAID. Yes, organizations enmeshed in the evangelical world, Big Evo, whatever, they are also, some of them on that train, and others are indirectly associated or directly associated with people like Matthew Sorens. So this is, it's all interconnected. It's a whole den of corruption, in my opinion. We could just go on and on and on with this stuff. Traveling this morning, Matthew Soren says, in Adrian, Georgia in 2019, Joel Tooley and I co-leading a discussion with the Nazarene pastors on how the Bible guides a Christian response to immigrants. Did you say they couldn't have land? Did you? How biblical was it, Joel? Matthew. DACA, more DACA stuff, more Nazarene stuff. Here's Matthew Sorens again, proud of my friend in Floridian. Joel, he really likes Joel Tooley. They must be close. Joel is a Nazarene pastor and was with me in El Paso earlier this week. We met with people on the Mexican side of the border. This isn't about Democrats or Republicans. Sure, it's not, Matthew. It's about vulnerable people made in God's image. I'm sure it's not about Democrats or Republicans. All right. Well, there you go. And then let's see. We're switching gears a little bit here. Do we want to switch gears yet? Yeah, I think we'll switch. Well, actually, you know, let me talk about this. Christianity Today published an article. Christianity Today has not received U.S. aid funds. It's literally the front page of their website, which I find hysterical that they have to respond. But here's the thing. There are some of you out there who, and this was written, by the way, by Timothy Dalrymple, for those who want to know. Some of you out there are saying things that are not quite true. And I can understand why they're not quite true. What happened with this USAID thing is I think a lot of people started realizing they want an explanation for why their denomination or their organization went so far left. And this created an opportunity to understand it. Now, I pointed out before, you don't actually need this. It's kind of like what I just showed you. There's relationships involved. There's ideology involved. It's not all money. It's not all bags of cash. Bags of cash do make a difference, though, right? All of these, it's not one thing. There's a bunch of different things contributing to the present situation. I think ideology has a lot to do with it, to be quite honest with you. And this is my experience being in evangelical institutions. The money may provide an incentive, but people really do become ideologues. They become committed to this ideology. So that said, yes, though, there is. It's comforting maybe to think that it's not ideology. It's just bags of cash because that's easier to root out. And there are bags of cash going into different places. But one of the things that people started to do is they started to look up all the organizations they've been involved with and say, have they received government money? Now, you know, Megan Basham's has traced some of this. Enemies Within the Church traced some of this. I've talked about a lot of this. This has been going on for a long time, okay? And I guess what I want to say is this. There was a moment with the USAID stuff that people, there was this uptick in interest in these evangelical organizations. And so some people were falsely claiming, and I mean by people, mostly people without influence online, but they're claiming that an organization got USAID money when in fact they didn't. They may have gotten government money, but it wasn't USAID. And that's basically what's happening with Christianity Today right now. And this is a hard thing to understand. And if you want to understand it, David Morrell is doing a great job from Protestia talking about this. So he actually messaged me last night. And you know what this comes down to is tax credits. So the Christianity Today received tax credits. And here's the problem. In 2020 and 2021, Christianity Today paid a little over $700,000 in payroll taxes on roughly $10.2 million in payroll, which is pretty normal. But they claimed $1.8 million in credits, which is well over double what they paid. And those were aimed at firms that lost income, generally, that money. Christianity Today did not lose income. So those firms would not lay off employees. The whole point of them getting these tax credits, as I understand it, is so they wouldn't have to lay off employees. And a lot of this is from COVID, but they were fine. So what's the money for is the question. Even if Christianity Today argued that they were merely taking the same credits as everyone else, they would have to engage in very creative bookkeeping in order to claim they are due $1.1 million over what they actually paid in payroll taxes, particularly since their gross receipts were up both years over the 2019 preference point. So it's not about, I'm just reading what David Morrell sent me. So it's not about their editorial positions being beholden to the federal government. It's about whether, even if their creative bookkeeping makes it legal, it's ethical for a Christian organization to take $1.8 million from taxpayers intended to prevent layoffs at companies that were shut down forcibly over COVID and or experienced substantial income loss. But we didn't take U.S. aid money claim is true. And unfortunately, the mistake by some outlets in claiming they did will serve as a convenient distraction. Very prudent. I love David Morrell. He does great work and he gets right to the heart of this. And I'm glad that he did this so I didn't have to research it myself too deeply. The issue is they did take government money. It's not USAID money, though. And so they're able to go out there and trot out a headline. We didn't take USAID money. Right. USAID is only one piece of the pie. You took a different piece of the pie. And there's a lot of questions about why you took such a large piece. That's it. And Christianity Today is not off the hook, in my opinion, for this. You're taking money during the Biden administration. Why? Is there an explanation for this that makes sense? So far, the explanations don't seem to make much sense. Now, I think we're going to switch gears a little bit. Yeah, because we got some other issues other than immigration. I wanted to show you this. This is Doug Ponder, who is going to get credit for this, at Doug Ponder. I think he might have even written something for CBN, the Center for Baptist Leadership, CBL, about this. But the president of Lifeway openly advocated for functional egalitarianism. Let me play this clip. This is important for you Southern Baptists.
If I was a woman, I would feel hurt. My daughter, when I went to back to the church we planted on our 7th anniversary, I told the kids, if any of you would have the courage to stand up and talk and share a story, share a memory. And so my daughter got up there, notes in hand, and absolutely crushed it. A well-meaning church member came up afterwards and said, "It's too bad you're a girl." That made me so mad.
Yeah.
Because I do not want my daughter to feel like because she's a woman, her voice doesn't matter. She cannot teach. She cannot be involved. Moving forward and understanding why high capacity women need to be in the room where it happens. They need to be helping making the decisions while we also respect our doctrinal boundaries.
Right.
Churches that are doing this really well are getting creative. Mm-hmm. They're saying, let's put an advisory council together, like men and women that just meet regularly, talk about the vision and strategy of the church. Let's get away from nomenclature. Let's just... Mm-hmm. Let's get the right people in the room and dream up what the future of the church is.
Okay. Well, there you have it. 1 Timothy 2:12, of course, says that Paul says that I do not permit a woman to teach nor have authority over a man. And there you have right there in front of you the Lifeway president, which he's high up in the SBC hierarchy, saying the opposite. And you say, John, he didn't say the opposite. He technically didn't. Okay, here's the thing. You want an advisory board. So this is part of the hierarchy of a church, and it's composed of men and women. This was the problem I saw at Southeastern, too. You had, I think, when I was at Southeastern, I don't know if it's still the case, a woman who was the chair of the board at Southeastern, as I remember. But you certainly had women on the board, and this was something J.D. Greer was trying to do at his church. We're trying to find places for women to be as authoritative as possible while technically not holding the office of a pastor, so they can still teach. Even I think Danny Aiken even said, I want a softer or a kinder, gentler, kinder complementarianism. And this would include women at certain times, even preaching to an audience that's mixed and these kinds of things. Well, the problem I see with all of this is it disregards the whole reason for why Paul says that he does not permit a woman to teach. The whole reason for hierarchies like this in scripture is because of something in nature. It's because of the way God designed women, the way God designed men. And he designed women for particular purposes. He designed men for particular purposes. And so if you want to be in accordance with the function that God has made in and wired into creation, then that's what obedience looks like. But they want to disregard all that. And this is the attack we see today. And this is why I wrote my book, Against the Waves, Christian Order in a Liberal Age, because the attacks are on creation. And they're not, it's not even an answers in Genesis kind of, like direct attack, all of it. A lot of it is, what I mean is like, they're not going back and saying like, oh, it's evolution or something. Like they don't have to. They just start saying that God didn't design the world this way. This isn't the way that things function, as if God just arbitrarily said, well, women can't be pastors. And there's no justification for it other than he just said so. That's not the case. There's a reason for these things. And obviously this is a problem. When the president of Lifeway doesn't seem to understand or doesn't agree with the reason for that, then he needs to go. And this does undercut your documents, your doctrinal statements in the SBC. There's no doubt about it. This undercuts it because it's the same thing with the homosexual thing, right? Like you start saying, well, same-sex attraction is not a sin. The next step is if it's not a sin, then there's no logical reason to say the action is sinful. Why would the action be sinful when the desire for it is not, right? You're creating the same problem here. In fact, maybe it's worse because you're saying like a woman can hold all these authoritative positions, even over a pastor potentially with this board. So they can have all the authority and power, but they just can't be a pastor. How does it make any sense? It doesn't. but this is what you have from the Southern Baptist, and you've had it for a long time. And I think this is why the law amendment failed. I know there's a lot of folks out there who want to say that this was all politics. It's all the platform. I think the platform is a big part of it, but I think there's a lot of people trained in the seminaries. And I know because I was trained at Southeastern, I heard this stuff, guys. Like, I know what was in the sausage. I saw how it was made. And the guys graduating in my group, a lot of them were complete ideologues, and they became radicalized, some of them at Southeastern. And they're some of them probably full-blown egalitarians, but they're on their way there. And this is a halfway measure to get there. It's a reconciliation with egalitarianism is what it is. And there's a lot of folks making up the SBC who believe this. And I know some people want to disregard that, deny that. Okay, the people in the pews aren't like that yet, but your leadership class is becoming, I don't know what the percentages are, but they're becoming more like this. By Faith Magazine put something out I wanted to highlight, and this, we're going back to the immigration issue, but not really. So this is a statement from the Mission to North America. Mission to North America serves the PCA for the advancement of Christ's kingdom through our churches in the U.S. and Canada. So it's kind of like, if you're in the SBC, this is kind of like the North American Mission Board. And they say that one longstanding MNA ministry is our refugee and immigrant ministry. Recently, we posted links on our webpage to external organizations offering a wide range of recommendations and frequently asked questions on immigration. MNA's leadership erroneously allowed the posting of content that advised undocumented persons on ways to avoid being detained by authorities. We affirm that it is our Christian duty to obey the law that commands civil magistrates to be subject to their authority. So the council otherwise is a sin. We confess that we fell short of our biblical confessional standard. We repent and apologize. Now, this doesn't happen much. They're apologizing for assisting illegal migrants with how to essentially avoid the law and avoid being detained by authorities. Now, I'm pretty positive about this, or at least I was when I first read it. And this is about immigration, but like I said, it's not, because I got a text message here. I don't know if the person wants me to say who they are, so I'm not going to say who they are. But someone, let's just say, who has some authority in the PCA. And they said that many conservatives are praising this response. There are so many deep-seated problems with the MNA that go beyond this specific mistake. MNA leadership needs to go. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm not going to, like, I guess, go out there and pray. I mean, I want to praise this. I want to say, oh, like, you don't see this happen. Now, I think what happened, though, is it's so egregious. What they did was so egregious, like they had to go out there and say this. The other organizations I showed you aren't, I don't think at least, doing this, you know, directly. And they went beyond what they, where they had political capital to go. They quite literally were assisting in illegal migration. Erin, I don't know if I'm saying his name right. I know I've talked about him before, but I think it's INCE. So however you pronounce that, Erwin is his first name, who I guess heads up the MNA. He is known for pushing wokeism. He has been pushing racial reconciliation for a long time. He hires progressives at MNA. Surprise, surprise. How did you get to this point? You had to have been doing that. The two latest examples were a woman who worked for MNA mentioned on her social media that the assassination attempt on Trump was staged. Okay. And another signed that the immigrant statement and included her position at MNA under her signature. What was the immigration statement? I'm not sure which one he's talking about, but one I suppose in, you know, against the Trump administration's policies or our law. And insinuated that it was an official MNA endorsement. So it's just, so there's things like this. So they're apparently, as I understand it from someone who I trust in the PCA, it's kind of a rat's nest, this MNA, and meaning that there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of problems. And so he was basically saying, like, look, don't go out there and just praise the organization. If you want to say that this statement is good, it's good that they, like, look at this egregious behavior and said, we're not for that. That's good. But don't just give them, like, don't give them trust because of this. I think that's wise. And I'm glad that he texted that to me, so I wouldn't do that. What else we got? Okay, I want to talk about the pro-life stuff for a minute, or I don't know, anti-abortion stuff. So Protestia published this: major pro-life groups joined forces with Planned Parenthood to defeat abolitionist bill. And you look into it, if you can look past the advertisements, it looks like a cute dog, but I'm not going to click on the video. There was a bill introduced in for equal protection and abolition, House Bill 1373. What state is this? North Dakota. North Dakota, by the way, I don't know if it was defeated or if it's still in process. Someone introduced a bill to, I think, dedicate the state to Christ, which I think is awesome, or like acknowledge Christ's kingship or something. I'm like, what's going on in North Dakota? This is great. Anyway, sponsored by Representative Lori Van Winkle. Went to the floor to vote. The bill would have added a section to North Dakota's laws to modify the definition of human being in person as the terms relate to the offense of murder and assault and civil actions for death caused by wrongful acts. The term human being would now include an unborn child. Okay, so they're trying to say, like, we have laws against murder, so let's not murder the unborn. Seems pretty logical, right? Now, it goes on, and it says that the bill, and this is the case with a lot of these bills, it's a miracle this bill even made it to the floor for a vote, because a lot of these bills don't. But so I retract what I just said. So it is the case of a lot of these bills, but this one actually did make it to a vote. As a professional, pro-life movement historically works tirelessly to ensure these types of bills don't get a hearing. This is true even in states like North Dakota, where they have super majorities, so the Republicans control everything. Instead, when the bills of abortion of abolition are introduced for consideration, professing pro-life organizations jump into action and put pressure on these groups. So here's what he says. We saw the ERLC and dozens of pro-life groups do it in Louisiana, and we saw multiple groups do it in North Dakota, where they pressure politicians against personhood bills. Students for Life signed a letter against an equal protection resolution. Most of the time, this has to do with they don't want to criminalize women for having abortions, which is what these would do. And Kristen Hawkins, president, Students for Life of America, signed this. And so I guess that's what they wanted to say. So I don't know that the ERLC was actually directly, I'm trying to look to see where the ERLC comes into this. Maybe they don't. Doesn't look like they do, but pro-life groups do. So here's what I wanted to say about this whole thing, because I posted a little short earlier this week, and I asked the question, look, if you have something like, and I'm trying to create a parallel here to make it make sense, but like a heartbeat bill, what do you do if you're a representative? What if, and I gave the analogy, what do you do if you're in Congress or some elected body, and it comes down to one vote, and the question is whether or not children should be prevented or barred from looking at pornography online, right? And there are laws like that that have made their way into law in conservative states. What do you do? Or, you know, take, you know, a hypothetical more so, because I think child pornography is illegal in every state, but let's say it wasn't and that was the law. Like, we're going to make child pornography illegal. What do you do? Or here's another hypothetical. We have laws against manslaughter and against murder and these kinds of things, and someone is challenging them and wants to reduce protections for people or create, you know, say that, I don't know, certain classes of people don't have these laws applied to them. And, you know, or and they, let's say they're just opposing these laws. We don't want a law that says you can't murder or adults or whatever. What do you do if it comes down to your vote? Do you defend the law that's on the books, the status quo, which actually does punish murder, but it's only for one class. It's for adults. Like, it's not effectively punishing murder of the unborn. I mean, are you compromised at that point, right? This is a question that I asked. And the assumption, so there's some people who are abolitionists who have the assumption that is by nature a compromise, because you are, they'll add to that. In my opinion, they're adding this extra kind of this extra thing where they say you are choosing to ignore or not protect a certain class of people. And I think the conditions matter. So in a situation where it's a bill that just says we're going to punish people who kill those with a heartbeat, right? And that's all it says, let's say. I don't think you're saying that I'm for killing people who don't have a heartbeat necessarily. Especially if you're in a situation where the status quo is you can kill any child before a certain stage, and you're limiting that, you're saying we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to protect these people, but you can't get a bill through that protects everyone, right? What do? I think that you push as hard as you possibly can for protecting everyone under the law. But then and this is how politics works, it's the art of the possible. If you can't get all of that, then you protect those you can protect, right? It's like someone posted the train scenario, the train track scenario, and said, well, you're choosing to kill this one person instead of these 10 people. I said, it's not even that. You're choosing to save people. You're not choosing to kill anyone. You can have a clean conscience, I think, in that scenario. It's just like, you know, the starfish thing. You're at the beach and I'm not saying a moral equivalency, but a practical equivalency. You can only save how many starfish? You can't save all of them. So you save the ones you can save, right? And then you come back and you push and you push and you push. This is how the left gets their way. They are willing to take whatever measures they can take. And then they come back the next year and they push and they push and you get sick of them because they don't go away until they get their way. I think that's what we should do as pro-life or anti-abortion advocates, whether you're pro-life, abolitionist, just anti-abortion, whatever you call yourself, you're against abortion. I think that's the strategy. You just keep pushing this issue. The problem, as I've showed before, though, is that the polling is very bad on this issue. Even in, I think, I wouldn't be surprised in red states if, I mean, we've already seen these anti-abortion initiatives fail in places like Ohio. The polling is not what many, I think it is or should be. And so the expectations, and especially in deep red states like North Dakota or Idaho or Oklahoma, is, look, the people are against abortion. They're controlled by Republicans. They're the ones holding us back. We should be able to get this done. And I understand that. It makes sense to me, actually. I don't know, though, to what extent people are really thinking consistently about this issue. There's a lot of education that needs to happen, probably, on this issue. And so that's a big part of this problem. But there's a huge problem with these pro-life organizations. And so I just want to say this as someone who has said, I think there are ways and situations and conditions, and that's important for me to say. This is a situational thing. As far as the morality is not situational, it's wrong to murder, but the political approach, I think, can be situational. I'm in New York. It's going to be a lot different here. So, if you enshrine in doctrine only this approach, this strategy is the right approach, and it's not necessarily based in a biblical framework. It's more conditional. It's like for people who live in deep red states, this strategy makes sense because it's just these compromising Republicans. I get that. That may be the case. But as someone who said, I think that there are different strategies that must be employed depending on where you are and what the situation looks like to move that needle as far as you possibly can to obtain power and use it to protect the lives of these vulnerable unborn people. And they are people. I think that the pro-life industry is an inhibitor, is a problem in a lot of this. And we are going to need, I think, in the next 2 years, some wins on the pro-life anti-abortion front. Trump, it's been said Trump has about 2 years and then campaigning starts again. I think that for Christians who care about the abortion issue on the state level, we're going to need something to continue. The movement's going to continue, but to make sure that it maintains the level of relevance. Otherwise, I do think it fades for a while. I don't know for how long, but it is wise to push now. I'm glad people are introducing stuff to try to get this done. And in fact, I want to commend someone. I didn't actually have this pulled up, but I will look for it now. See if I can find it. Because there is a bill like this that was introduced in the state of Idaho, and I actually did a Twitter thread on it because I'm kind of disgusted by the leadership of these states. That here it is. So this is probably the final thing I'm going to talk about on the podcast. Jim Guthrie, who is the Idaho, I want to make this guy famous a little bit. Idaho Senate State Affairs Committee Chair has made headlines for his decision to block a full committee hearing on Senator Brandon Shippey's, Shippey's Idaho Prenatal Equal Protection Act. This bill aimed to eliminate exceptions for rape and incest in Idaho's abortion ban and grant legal personhood at fertilization. Amen. Guthrie's decision to not advance Shippey's bill is significant because it reflects the hypocrisy within the Republican Party on abortion. And this is what I wanted to highlight. There is a hypocrisy going on this. It's one thing to say, hey, what we believe isn't popular in this region. This is the strategy we need to employ to ensure that we can save as many lives as possible and push that needle and get to the point where we can have a bill that applies to every person. But that's not what's happening. You have these guys who I think are just sellouts. They're not even allowing the bill to be heard. This guy is apparently a Mormon, or at least he comes from a Mormon family. He's known for being a part of the conservative wing of the Idaho legislature, but his actions demonstrate he's more of a rhino. And there's others who have said this. The Idaho Freedom Foundation has issues with him on this. Apparently the guy had an affair in 2016. I'm just throwing that out there to be like, you know, is he, I don't know if Mormons, I don't think Mormons are supposed to do that. But anyway, the refusal to hear Shippey's bill might be interpreted as a strategic move to avoid party division or legal challenges. But why not at least give the bill a hearing? And then that's my question. Why not give the bill a hearing like it was in North Dakota? Why not let it be voted on? Get people on the record on this issue. Now, the reality is, at the end of the day, on this issue of abortion, there are differences between this and issues like manslaughter. For example, I should rephrase that, manslaughter of adults. When you have someone who's an adult that dies, generally they are ingrained in the system, quote unquote, right? They have employers know they're missing. There's tracking on them. They have social security number, right? They have identity. And that identity is taken into account. Much easier to track in these kind of, when it's a baby, when it's in the womb, when there's no tracking and stuff. The left is right that you're going to have back alley abortion. That it doesn't have to happen at a back alley. You just have rogue doctors operating out of their homes or something. This is going to happen. And no law is going to restrict all of that because you can't detect all of it. So there's no standard you can get to where the law is going to be able to, for example, you can limit abortifacients coming into your state, but there's still going to be a black market for them. People are going to take them, and you know how many, I don't know, but you're not going to be able to completely limit it. But the point is, our laws should still demonstrate and reflect that these are people, and it's about the moral conscience of your state or your region or your country. It's wrong to murder, and that's what should be reinforced. Even if people violate it, we still have the standard, and we've publicly agreed this is the standard. If you don't have that, then I think that, yeah, you will suffer the penalty for that. And that could just mean judgment from God. That could mean a number of things. And I don't know. I don't pretend to know what God's doing. You know, we have 4 years, I think, to work towards this issue on the state level. At the very least, we have 2 years, I think, to get a win. And beyond that, I don't know. If a Democrat gets back in there and they have the political will to enshrine Roe v. Wade in a federal law or a court decision or something, then we get set back a long ways. And this is the political reality of the situation. So I just want to commend, these state senators. Dusty Devers is another one who keep hammering this kind of thing. Whether you consider yourself pro-life, abolitionist, or anti-abortion of any stripe, you need to push this. Push this in your states as much as possible while paying attention to these other issues. But this is one area that's important, and I don't want it to be ignored or dismissed. I actually think, and I'm optimistic about this, that the logic of America First and the populism and all of this that's coming about, the anti-proposition nation stuff, I actually do think this lends itself to an anti-abortion logic, but it may take a while for us to work through that. And not everyone is logical. There's a lot of people that will adopt, they will adopt policies that reflect a certain principle, but they'll do so in an inconsistent fashion, because that's how people work. People aren't always consistent. And so anyway, just encourage you, keep pushing for that. Don't forget about these pro-life organizations or anti-abortion or abolitionist organizations. I would hope that we would be all on the same team, but some of these national pro-life organizations are demonstrating that they're not. And the ERLC of the Southern Baptist Convention is right up there with them, and they need to be disbanded, not just because of that, but because of that too. So my two cents. All right. Well, God bless. I got to catch a ride now. I got a long weekend ahead of me. You can pray for me. I'm involved in a project. I'll just put it that way. I'm involved in an important project, in my opinion. I just need your prayers. So I thank everyone out there for the support. God bless. More coming. Bye now.